So we've talked about cooperation and we've talked about defection. When we first started talking about cooperation, we were talking about cooperation actually as it can occur within a single genome, that is, within a single individual. Then we talked about cooperation more formally, and what we focused on was cooperation as it can occur within a given species, that'd be intraspecific cooperation. Those ideas can be expanded to include between species, but we really considered it mostly from the perspective of an individual species and the members of that species interacting with one another. They may have varied in terms of the degree to which they would cooperate or defect, but by and large, we were considering just cooperation within a species. When we talked about mutation occurring, mutation to a less cooperative genotype, we're talking still about cooperation going on within a given species. Even when we talked about defection from without, these individuals, these cheaters, this, I guess cheating from without, moving into a group of cooperative cells, we really were thinking at that point either in terms of within species, so a defector that is just a different genotype but still the same species, or alternatively, perhaps a parasite, which would be a different species. In the following chapter, we talk about symbioses and we concentrated on mutualisms. And mutualisms basically, and symbioses are basically interactions between different species. And if the mutualism is a cooperative phenomenon, which indeed it is, then we're talking about cooperation between different species. In this chapter, which is on virulence, we're going to be talking also about cooperation as it can occur within species. And defection as it can occur between species. So in this case, the defection is obvious. Virulence is the capacity to cause disease, so defection is the potential to cause disease in a host organism as affected by a parasite. The cooperation, however, is within the parasite population, and particularly we're going to return to these ideas of showing restraint, such as upon one's population growth. A lack of restraint can lead to an increase in the amount of virulence seen, and that might actually have negative consequences in terms of the fitness of a pathogen. And if that's the case, then those pathogens that can figure out how to cooperate within the pathogen population, especially within populations of pathogens that are infecting a single host, then that population of pathogens may display a greater fitness than a population of pathogens that shows less restraint on its capacity to cause disease in the host. And what level of virulence ultimately will evolve will be dependent upon the degree to which these pathogens can display restraint, can be cooperative within pathogen populations, in combination with what degree of virulence actually gives rise to an optimal fitness for the pathogen. And whether or not the pathogen can realize that level of virulence will be dependent upon the degree to which the pathogen population essentially can display kin selection, to the extent they can be clonal and they can take advantage of inclusive fitness in order to show restraint and thereby restrain themselves at whatever the optimal virulence for the population may be. So the general theme of this chapter is virulence. Virulence is either an interspecific defection or it can involve an intraspecific cooperation, and particularly we're interested in the evolution of virulence. So the evolution of parasite virulence. So the idea of virulence and its evolution has had a somewhat tortured history. It has gone from a perspective that was not very evolutionary, even though it tried to sound evolutionary, to one that is very much adaptive. Trying to understand things from an evolutionary ecological perspective, that is, in terms of fitness. And particularly, the fitness that is of concern is the fitness of the parasite. So, the evolution of virulence, although virulence is something that impacts the host organism, it's something that we study from the perspective, especially, of the parasite itself. It's the evolution of the parasite in terms of its virulence. Although, as we'll see, the parasite's ability to affect the host in terms of its in terms of the host's health can have an impact on the parasite's fitness also. So for most of the 20th century, the prevailing dogma was that disease organisms eventually should evolve towards benign coexistence with their host. That is, harmful diseases were interpreted as a transitory state of maladaptation. That's maladaptation on the part of the parasite. This view arose more from assumptions about the harmony of nature rather than from rigorous application of evolutionary principles. Specifically, it failed to cast the problem in the context of natural selection. Rather than asking whether harmful or mild variants of parasites, again, would win out in competition with each other over the short run, the focus was on what was stable over the long run. Natural selection, however, is powerless to favor long-term stability if the variants that win in the short term destabilize the system. Natural selection may favor the evolution of extreme harmfulness if the host exploitation that causes this harm enhances the competitive success of the harmful variants over benign variants in the short run. If predator-like variants of a pathogen population outproduce and out-transmit benign variants, then benign coexistence between predator and host may be precluded. So we really don't know what level of virulence is going to give rise to an optimal fitness for the pathogen, nor whether the pathogen is going to be able to realize that level of virulence. But we do have some sense of where that level of virulence should lie, and it really is a function of the degree to which a level of virulence is either a help or a hindrance to what's known as parasite transmission, in combination with whether or not the parasite population infecting a single host can take advantage of kin selection and inclusive fitness in order to restrain the level of virulence that the population that the parasite population as a whole displays around whatever the optimal virulence is, the optimal level of harm to the host that coincides with the maximal parasite fitness. So this is a cartoon that I actually generated, I believe, in 1995. This would be the first term that I ever taught. And I was teaching microbiology, just micro, at that time it was micro 509, introductory microbiology for nurses. And I wanted to bring into it something that I was very excited about at the time, was trying to understand the virulence of pathogens, particularly in the context of the evolution of virulence in bacteriophages. Which is ultimately turned into the figure that I've been showing over and over again about the competition between expedient and economical bacteriophages. But at any rate, I put together this figure to give students a sense of how virulence can vary and how the level of virulence that a pathogen imposes upon its host, the degree of sickness that the pathogen makes the host, can have an impact on the fitness of the pathogen. And that impact is particularly in terms of the ability of the pathogen to be transmitted. So what we have here is me sick in bed because I have some kind of pathogen that's infecting me and making me really sick to the point where I'm not going to work. And here alternatively is me sufficiently healthy that I can still go to work, but I'm still sick and therefore I'm still coughing, for example, and able to transmit whatever is infecting me to others. So for some pathogens, more virulence means less contact with new hosts. These would be the new hosts to which progeny may be transmitted. And what that means is that this individual here, me, sick in bed, although I may be producing more pathogens and I may be transmitting more pathogens out into the environment that surrounds me, there's no one there to for those pathogens to land on to make sick. In the instance where I'm coming to work, I'm less sick. I potentially am producing fewer pathogens, and I'm sending fewer of those pathogens off into the environment that surrounds me, but there are more individuals there. In fact, there are individuals there that could potentially become infected by, as a consequence of my coughing on them. So the potential for transmission is greater here, even though the amount of pathogen that may be leaving my body at any given time could be smaller. So to succeed evolutionarily, a parasite has to be transmitted before its host either dies or eliminates it. So a parasite is living in an environment that represents a dead end for it. It's not going to be able to persist in that environment forever. And as a consequence, it has to somehow balance out its need to replicate within that environment with the fact that ultimately it's got to get out of that environment in order for the parasite to persist over the long term. Greater transmission ability and therefore greater pathogen success, greater parasite fitness, may come as a consequence of reduced virulence, that is, making the host less sick, if that reduced virulence can coincide with greater opportunities, a greater potential for the parasite to be transmitted to new hosts. And again, getting back to the idea of restraint, showing a lower amount of virulence, making your host less sick, may require the population of parasites in that infecting a single host to not get out of hand in terms of their replication or otherwise in terms of their making the host sick if they want to retain some optimal level of virulence within that host so that their likelihood of transmission is maintained at a high level. So let's return to what exactly a parasite is. In a symbiosis, there is a symbiont and typically a host. You'll have a larger organism and a smaller organism, such as a microorganism. Although parasites can consist of, for example, insects and worms and things like that, protozoa, and also viruses. So in these interactions, the symbiont almost always is going to be displaying some fitness advantage that it gets out of the interaction. It's living on or in association with some other organism for a reason. The host organism, on the other hand, may not be gaining from the interaction. And in fact, it either is going to be gaining from the interaction, or it's going to not be affected by the interaction, or instead, the interaction is going to cost the host in some capacity. So we call mutualisms those interactions between two species in which both individuals gain. So here the host would gain if this is a symbiotic interaction. A commensalism are those interactions in which the host doesn't gain, but the host isn't harmed either. And then finally, parasitism is an example of a situation in which the one organism gains and the other organism loses. So in the case of a symbiosis, the symbiont gains and the host organism loses. And you can see from the presentation here that this is simply part of a larger scheme of things that includes predation. With a predation, the predator, of course, gains and the prey loses. And the larger scheme is that there are exploiter-victim interactions where the exploiter gains from the interaction and the victim loses from the interaction. With parasitism, the exploiter is the parasite and the victim is the host. So let's talk about parasite virulence and do so from a perspective that's helpful towards understanding its evolution. So there are other ways of considering parasite virulence. Of course, there's the whole pathogenicity, the interaction between the parasite and host that's often studied in molecular terms, and we can figure out parasite virulence factors and different ways that the parasite can make the host sick or not make the host sick or able to evade the host immune system or not. These are not really going to be our emphases. We're going to be speaking yet again in more general terms in order to understand what is going on in terms of a parasite's evolution of greater or lower virulence, where what's important in terms of greater or lower virulence is a combination of the impact on the host health, that is basically what defines the level of virulence, and the impact on the pathogens or the parasite's fitness. So virulence is typically described as the capacity for a parasite or a pathogen to harm a host organism. So in other words, the ability to cause disease or potential to cause disease. Evolutionarily, we would typically describe virulence in terms of host fitness. So in other words, the greater the virulence, the greater the level of disease, the lower the potential for the host organism to ultimately reproduce. This could be because its reproduction is delayed. It could be because its reproduction is reduced because the host organism doesn't have as much body mass as it would have otherwise if it hadn't been sick. It could be because the host is more susceptible to predation by other organisms. It doesn't really matter. What's important is that we are defining the level of impact of the virus on the host in terms of the host fitness. We're defining virulence in terms of its impact on host fitness. The higher the virulence, the less of the potential that the host has to reproduce as a consequence of that disease. The capacity for a parasite to reduce a host fitness, for example, by debilitating the host or by directly killing the host, therefore is a description of the parasite's virulence. This capacity often can vary from infection to infection or infestation to infestation. This is dependent upon the parasite, it's dependent upon the host, but there's also variation within parasite populations that is genetically based that impacts the degree to which the parasite causes or is able to cause disease in a host organism. Therefore, there is variation in the parasite population. There's phenotypic variation, that is in terms of the level of virulence, and therefore in principle there can be evolution by natural selection acting on that virulence. And if there is a level of virulence that gives rise to a higher potential for the parasite to reproduce and be transmitted to new hosts, then you would expect natural selection to favor that level of virulence. So this variance can be a function of host factors, including host genetics. It can be a function of parasite factors, including parasite genetics. And also can be a function of environmental factors, things that are outside of the host-pathogen interactions. But together, these factors give rise to some level of virulence that's seen on a per-infection basis. And that level of virulence can vary, at least in part, as a function of parasite genetics, what alleles the parasite carries. Virulence variance, that is variation in the degree of virulence, the degree of disease cause, complicates considerations of virulence evolution, but it's nonetheless consistent with basic evolutionary principles. So what that means is that although we have variance in virulence that's a function of the parasite's genetics, we also have variation in virulence that's a function of other things as well. And therefore, when a parasite enters into a host, there's more than just its own genetics that's impacting the level of disease that's being caused. Nevertheless, in terms of natural selection acting upon the parasite, what's important is the genes, the alleles that the parasite carries, and the extent to which those alleles vary in terms of their impact in an average general sense. Averaged across infections, their impact on the amount of disease that the parasite is able to cause to the host. That is to say that the Darwinian fitness of a parasite is going to be both context and genotype dependent, both dependent upon the factors outside of the parasite, such as the host genotype and host phenotype, but also the genotype of the parasite itself. And when you have variance in genotype within a population, then evolution can occur. So we can also talk about virulence in terms of proximate versus ultimate causation. Again, we are used to thinking of virulence in terms of proximate causation. So this is an example of proximate causation. We've got a bacterium, it happens to be Vibrio cholerae, and it produces a toxin, cholera toxin, that gives rise to the disease cholera. It's interesting in part because the cholera toxin is actually encoded by a bacteriophage. That is serving as or existing as a prophage within the bacterium, and it's the expression of the cholera toxin off of the bacteriophage that ultimately gives rise to cholera. But although all that stuff is interesting and can be studied from an evolutionary perspective, all of this is a proximate description of the causing of disease by cholera. How is it that cholera causes disease? Different question is, why is it that cholera causes disease? Not why is it in a mechanistic sense, but why is it in an evolutionary sense? What is it that cholera gets out of producing this cholera toxin and thereby causing disease? How does that impact the fitness, particularly increase the fitness of cholera as a pathogen? So the proximate cause of virulence, such as the acquisition of toxic genes, along with the molecular details of its action. And those are not the things that we're going to be stressing. Instead, we'll be considering ultimate causation. How does having toxin or expressing a toxin improve fitness? And this we're going to consider particularly in terms of the potential for parasite fitness. How does cholera as a pathogen producing and releasing cholera toxin result in cholera being able to move it and its progeny to new individuals that can then be infected by cholera and continuing the process? And the answer to some degree is actually relatively easy in this case. So cholera toxin leads to a large amount of diarrhea, which may aid in the ability of the cholera bacterium to replicate, but certainly causes movement of the cholera bacterium out of the host organism and does so in a particularly messy manner that has a fairly high potential to contaminate water supplies, and therefore cholera may be assuring its transmission or increasing its likelihood of transmission by producing this toxin and causing this diarrhea. So ultimately, if you'll pardon the pun, our interest will be in ultimate causation. Why is it that an organism is displaying especially greater virulence versus lesser virulence? And this idea of focusing on this somewhat abstract idea of virulence is very similar to when you're studying the evolution of microorganisms or organisms generally and just focusing on fitness. It's just that virulence and fitness don't necessarily go hand in hand. Greater virulence won't necessarily lead to greater fitness. Lesser virulence won't necessarily lead to greater fitness. So there's not a one-to-one direct correspondence between fitness and virulence. But nonetheless, our interest will be in how an organism's lifestyle affects its virulence, and our bottom line will be to what degree does a given level of virulence impact an organism's fitness. So ultimate causation is our interest. So what about the evolution of virulence and parasites? So in terms of virulence evolution, we can describe parasites as differing genetically in ways that affect their impact on the host's Darwinian fitness. So remember, their impact on the host's Darwinian fitness, because it's a negative impact, we describe as virulence. So again, variation in genetic variation within the parasite population. There's variation in terms of genes that have an impact on virulence. And when that's the case, when there are different virulence level alleles, then you can have evolution with the parasite population for some optimal level of virulence. Thus, parasites can possess different alleles that give rise to differing levels of capacity to reduce a host fitness, and these can be described as virulence determinants. Note that parasites do not harm hosts simply for the sake of causing harm to those hosts, but instead it is a byproduct, this harm, of parasite replication and or parasites' mechanisms of transmission to new hosts. The parasite's job is to make more parasites and get those parasites to a new host to infect, and doing its job can have a side effect of harming the host. Because host organisms are both mortal and finite, that is, eventually they die, the host organisms eventually die, and they're only so large, there's only so much host organism to go around. The bottom line in considerations of parasite fitness is their potential for transmission to new hosts. So how do you make up for the fact that a host is going to die eventually, even if of natural causes, and that the host is only so large, there's only so many cells, for example, to infect in the case of a virus. The answer is that you can increase the amount of host tissue available to you if you can in fact find new hosts. And so a parasite, in order to be an ongoing presence within a community, has to be able to find new hosts. So it's bottom line for a parasite in terms of the parasite's fitness is whether or not it's able to eventually find a new host. If it can't find a new host, if it can't release progeny that go on to find new hosts, then the parasite's fitness is essentially zero. Thus, parasites live and reproduce within host environments at the expense of host Darwinian fitness. They make the host sick. And they do so for the sake of being transmitted to new host environments. And the extent to which a parasite can be transmitted, is transmitted to new hosts, it really defines the parasite's fitness. Again, if the parasite is unable to be transmitted to new hosts, then its fitness is essentially zero. So we can return to economy and expediency in trying to understand these ideas of parasite fitness. The economical use of limiting resources is a case of altruism because of a trade-off between specific growth rate, that is, rate of biomass increase per unit time and also per unit biomass, and the growth yield, that is, biomass formed per amount of resource used. High growth yield, in other words, the economical use of common resources, increases group fitness. However, this can only be attained at the cost of decreased growth rate, which decreases individual fitness. So if you're not growing very fast, then your fitness, at least instantaneously, is not as high as an organism that is growing fast. But over longer time frames, what's important can be the total number of individuals that are produced rather than how rapidly they're produced. And that's, of course, Kreft. So in the case of virulence, parasite virulence, the common resource, what that's being competed for, is host tissue. So it's whether or not host tissue is being efficiently converted into new parasite progeny or instead inefficiently converted. And symbionts can use that tissue either economically or expeditiously with either economy or expediency. With greater virulence, that is on a per parasite individual produced, defining lower levels of economy or higher levels of expediency. So if you are a parasite and your job is to get in there and make as many progeny as possible as quickly as possible, that would be an expedient strategy. But that strategy can be an inefficient use of host resources, and to the extent any use of host resources results in harm to the host, then that can be a more harmful strategy to the host per unit parasite produced than a more efficient strategy. We can also, not surprisingly, consider the evolution of virulence in terms of a prisoner's dilemma. We're thinking in terms here of intra-specific cooperation or intra-specific defection. So this is within a parasite's population. Recall that with a prisoner's dilemma, up here in the upper left-hand corner, we have mutual cooperation, a CC interaction with the payoff of R for reward for mutual cooperation. Down here in the lower right-hand corner, we have mutual defection, a DD interaction, where the payoff is P, which stands for punishment for mutual defection. Over here, we have unilateral defection. It's the payoff for being a defector in the midst of cooperators, one or more. And the payoff there is T, temptation to defect. And over here in the upper right-hand corner, we have unilateral cooperation. That's being a cooperator within a environment that contains defectors, one or more. And the payoff value for being a unilateral cooperator is S, which stands for the sucker's payoff. Now note that instead of using cooperation and defection over here, and cooperation defection up here, we've instead replaced those terms with economy and expediency. So economy corresponds to cooperation, expediency corresponds to defection. So when we have a mutually cooperative interaction, what that means is that it's an economical replicator, parasite, that's found within a population of economical parasites. Where we have mutual defection, instead, it's an expedient parasite that finds itself within a population of expedient parasites. Similarly, when we have the unilateral defection, the payoff of T, what we have is an expedient parasite found within a population of economical parasites. And when we have payoff value of S, the sucker's payoff, unilateral cooperation, we have an economical parasite that finds itself within a population of expedient parasites. So the upside of being economical is that by displaying restraint, the population has a greater potential of producing the level of virulence that is optimal for the parasite. If there's less restraint, then there will tend to be greater virulence than what is optimal for the parasite. So that's where the reward for mutual cooperation comes in. It allows the parasite to display overall a higher fitness because it's closer to its optimal virulence. It can hold its population closer to its optimal virulence because it's displaying, the individual members are displaying restraint. With mutual defection, by contrast, the individual members are not displaying restraint, and as a consequence, the population is less able or not able at all to hold the level of virulence that it's displaying to that level which is optimal. By displaying greater virulence than is optimal, the population's transmission ability is reduced, and as a consequence, the fitness of the individual members of the population are reduced. So that's the punishment for mutual defection. In the case of unilateral defection, what we have is an expedient individual within a population of economical individuals. Because the expedient individual is not a substantial portion of the overall population, the population as a whole tends to display something closer to mutual cooperation and therefore closer to the optimal level of virulence. But nevertheless, the expedient individual within that population is able to out-replicate the economical individuals. So you have the best of both worlds. You have a higher fraction of the population as a consequence of your expedient growth rate without having overall too much of an impact on the virulence displayed by the population. So therefore, higher numbers from faster population growth or more effective, greater levels of population growth in combination with a retention of a relatively high potential to be transmitted. In the case of the sucker's payoff, you're instead an individual that restrains its growth, restrains its impact on the host at the expense of its growth rate, but the population as a whole doesn't display that restraint, and so therefore there's suboptimal transmission and you're making up less and less a fraction of the total population, the sucker's payoff. Now recall in the prisoner's dilemma that there's always a greater fitness, at least in the short term, associated with individuals that defect, in this case are expedient, rather than ones that are economical. And so just like with the prisoner's dilemma generally, we have to ask the question, why should individual members of parasite populations display restraint and something that will have a potential to approximate mutual population rather than displaying defection? In other words, why don't parasites display the maximal level of virulence that they genetically conceivably have the potential to display? Why is it that, in fact, a parasite population may display levels of virulence that are lower than what could conceivably be obtained by a parasite population? And the answers to that question are quite similar to the answers that we came to when discussing cooperation, just in more abstract terms, but we'll get to that. We can also, perhaps not surprisingly, consider the evolution of virulence in terms of a tragedy of the commons. So remember the tragedy of the commons? They're essentially n-player prisoner's dilemmas. And there are tendencies that we can describe as defection behaviors, that is, as cheating, and also tendencies we can describe as cooperative. And what are those tendencies? So restraint is cooperative, and lack of restraint is a defection strategy. The consequence of lack of restraint is increased negative impacts on one's environment, the commons. And this results in overshooting of carrying capacities and degradation of the environment, such that they're less able to support the population in question. And in the case of parasites, what's going on is that virulence represents a negative impact on the environment. And the result of that negative impact on the environment can be a reduction in the potential for that environment to support the transmission or continuing transmission of parasites to new individuals to infect. And the environment that's being infected, when we are displaying this level, whatever level of virulence, the environment is the host or the host tissues. So basically, like a tragedy of the commons, virulence, especially virulence that is in excess of optimal virulence, represents a lack of restraint on the part of the parasite population, which results in sufficient levels of damage to the host and the host tissues that the host is no longer able to support the degree of transmission of the parasite population that would be the case if the parasite population instead was displaying an optimal level of virulence. So restraint requires some kind of cooperation among the parasites within the parasite population. And so you have to ask the question, how do you get there? How do you end up with a population that's showing mutual restraint, mutual cooperation? And as noted, the answer to that question is it's very consistent with how we have answered that question previously. And with the case of parasites, it has a lot to do with kin selection and inclusive fitness. In addition, restraint is more plausible given reproductive linkage between host and symbiont. And in fact, this is the explanation for why not all symbionts are parasites. Parasites can be parasites because they have the potential to jump ship. They are able to do harm to their host, in fact, to extents that impact their own ability to replicate or be transmitted, because in fact, they can transmit themselves from individual to individual, from host to host. Whereas other kinds of symbionts, which are less capable of being transmitted between hosts, are not in a position where they can do substantial amounts of harm to their host organism, particularly to the extent to which that harm can come back and result in them being harmed in terms of their ability to replicate or indeed move on to a new host organism. All symbionts have to move to new hosts eventually because hosts do not live forever and hosts are not infinite in size. And as a consequence of this, it is particularly those symbionts that are really good at being transmitted that have the potential to do harm. And you, in fact, see an evolution of parasitism, of higher levels of virulence. Whereas those parasites that don't have an easy means by which they can be transmitted to new hosts are only able to persist if they're able to restrain their virulence. And so you have this additional mechanism that's very important to the evolution of virulence, and in fact goes well beyond the evolution of commensalism or mutualism. Basically, if a parasite is not able to find new hosts as fast as it burns through its old hosts, if its reproductive number, as it's called, is not one or greater, where each infection gives rise to at least one new infection, then the parasite population will decline to the point of extinction. And one means by which this decline to extinction can be avoided is if the parasite populations infecting an individual host is able to reduce its level of virulence sufficiently so that the host can persist long enough, and the infection or colonization of that host can persist long enough that there is some potential to be transmitted to new hosts, even if those new hosts are few and far between. And we can describe these ideas where, on the one hand, there can be selection for increased levels of expediency or lack of restraint within a host body, and that can have a negative impact on the potential for a parasite to be transmitted to a new host as a parasite's dilemma. And as we've considered, the parasite's dilemma is very similar to the tragedy of the commons for other organisms, where in fact it is this potential to be transmitted that represents the commons that is negatively impacted by a lack of restraint on parasite growth. This is an experiment that employs a parasite of butterflies, and it's looking at the fitness of the parasite as a function of the number of spores that the parasite produces per host. And the more spores that are produced, the greater the burden on the host, and therefore the greater the virulence and the lower the opportunity for transmission, even though more spores might result in, at any given time, the host having more spores and therefore being able to transmit. The duration over which those spores may be transmitted might be shorter. And so what you have is a result that if you don't have enough spores, you don't have enough spores to achieve efficient transmission at any time. If you have too many spores, it results in a decrease in the duration, the window during which transmission can occur. And so there's this optimal virulence that was shown experimentally for this parasite, where some level of spores gives you not so many spores that you're excessively negatively impacting the fitness of the host organism, and not so few spores that the potential for transmission to occur at any good time, any specific time, is excessively low. So this parasite lifetime fitness is a measure of their transmission likelihood. And this parasite load is a measure of the parasite replication ability in association with a host. So what is expedient in this case? Expedient is producing so many spores that it hurts the host to the point where the transmission of those spores is reduced. Economical is holding back on your spore production to the point where you are able to experience an optimal transmission rate. And clearly, as this graph shows, you can hold back so much that, in fact, you're not producing enough parasite offspring, progeny, in order to effectively have those progeny transmit to new hosts. So there's some optimal level of virulence that a parasite is selected for in a parasite's population, and that optimal level of virulence requires restraint on the part of the parasite population infecting individual hosts in order for it to be realized. And so there's our optimal virulence. So going back to the prisoner's dilemma, this time looking at it as a prisoner's dilemma with cooperation and defection. R is our reward for mutual cooperation, P our punishment for mutual defection, T the temptation to defect, and S the sucker's payoff. So the parasite's dilemma is the following. So the parasite is displaying, when it's cooperating, it's displaying reproductive restraint and therefore economy. And when the parasite is displaying expediency, it's displaying a lack of reproductive restraint, which is defection. And greater virulence associated with the parasite population can give rise to this punishment for mutual defection, which is a consequence of the parasite population producing so much disease that the level of disease is negatively impacting the ability of the parasite population to be transmitted. On the other hand, there's a level of virulence that can be beneficial to parasite transmission, an optimal level of virulence, and that level of virulence is attainable, particularly when you have mutual cooperation, that is mutual restraint. A population of parasites infecting a single host that is displaying restraint on its population growth, and therefore not excessive virulence, and therefore able to sustain itself at some optimal level of virulence that maximizes the potential for the parasite to be transmitted to a new host. So the damage that is effected to the host, that the damage that is caused by a pathogen to the host, on a per pathogen individual produced basis. So that is for a pathogen replicates and a pathogen produces a certain number of individuals and causes a certain amount of damage to the host. So the amount of that damage can be more important to the pathogen than is to the host. So what do I mean by that? So an expedient pathogen can be one that in fact produces fewer pathogen progeny, fewer pathogen individuals for a given amount of host damage. So you're going in, you're damaging the host in the course of your replication or in the course of your life cycle, and you're producing fewer progeny pathogen individuals per the amount of damage that you're causing. And that could be more important to the pathogen, which is ending up with fewer individuals being produced, than it is to the host organism, because the host organism, at least on that per effort by the pathogen to reproduce basis, is being damaged the same amount. To the host, what's more important is the total amount of damage to tissues, since that amount of damage should roughly correlate with host fitness or inversely correlate. So the higher the amount of damage, the lower the host fitness. So it's the total amount of damage that gives rise to some total amount of reduction in host fitness. The parasite is trying to maximize its reproductive output. And this is especially to the extent that maximizes its transmission effectiveness. Although there can be a maximization of parasite reproductive output that does not result in a maximization of transmission efficacy. And it is the trade-off between those two things, attempting to maximize reproductive output and attempting to maximize transmission effectiveness, that can lead to what I've been describing as the parasite's dilemma. Virulence is a function not just of parasite reproductive output, but also the amount of tissue damage that results from that output. So if a parasite could set things up so that it had a high reproductive output without damaging its host at all, then it would not be displaying virulence. But the flip side to that is that a parasite variant that may in fact display a larger amount of virulent impact on its host, a large amount of damage in the course of its replication, might have an advantage over the non-damaging parasite, if such a thing could even exist. And as a consequence, selection within the parasite population can be for an increased amount of damage, and thus you have the potential for parasites evolving the potential to damage their hosts. The trick is to not have so much damage, however, that you result in a reduction in the parasite's ability to be transmitted. As a rule, the restraint required to display less virulent infection strategies. So again, you would have an expectation that even if you could have a parasite that was able to reproduce without hurting its host, it may be invaded by parasites that in fact can replicate faster at the expense of damaging their hosts. That even so, we might have an expectation that these parasite populations may not evolve indefinitely towards ever-increasing virulence, because those infection strategies that display less virulence might result in greater potential for the parasite population to be transmitted. So as a rule, the restraint required to display less virulent infection strategies may only involve to the extent that pathogen populations within a single host are closely related. So if there is an optimal level of virulence, competing pathogens may exceed that virulence by attempting to display greater within-host virulence. If you have a population that is clonally related or otherwise closely related, then that population may not have the same level of competition, if only because the individuals within that population will not necessarily display any genetic variation. And if you don't have genetic variation, you can't have evolution for increased virulence because there is no variation, genetic-based variation in virulence within the population. So if you have a population of pathogens that's initiated with just a single individual is clonal, or otherwise is very closely related, you may not have sufficient genetic variation within that population to allow for an evolution of ever greater virulence within that population infecting a single host. As a consequence of this, you can have populations infecting different hosts competing against each other, and it will be those populations that are more effective at transmitting that will ultimately transmit more progeny, and that level of virulence that gives rise to the most effective transmission, as displayed by a population of parasites infecting a single host, will be the level of virulence that natural selection will tend to favor. Even though if you had within-host competition going on, you might exceed that level of virulence. The trick, of course, is to avoid that within-host competition by keeping cooperating individuals cooperating with one another and excluding those individuals that instead would be cheaters. Believe it or not, this is the same type of experiment as we showed two slides earlier. Instead of looking at the phage population growth, however, and ultimate yield, instead we're looking at the phage impact on the bacterial population. So the bacterial population is growing, and we've added the phages, and the phages are infecting the bacteria. So what we have here is at this point, which is essentially a zero point for the phage infection, is the addition of a low multiplicity of phages. So there's a lot more bacteria than there are phages. The bacterial population continues to grow, but the phage population does as well, infecting, lysing, releasing progeny phages, which then go on to infect new bacteria. Now, these populations grow and grow and grow until all of the bacteria within the populations are infected, and then the populations are lysed, which is what these drops represent. Now, as the phages are growing their populations, the bacterial population is growing, the more slowly the phage population grows, then the greater the density of the bacterial of the bacterial population can grow too, and also the longer that the bacterial population can grow. The greater density ultimately results in more phages being produced because more bacterial cells are being infected. And the longer time the bacteria go before they're in fact lysed by the phages is a measure of the virulence displayed by the phages against this population of bacteria. So this is a clonal population of bacteria, and they display a certain amount of health that is a function of how many cells are present, and the peaks up here represent the maximum amount of bacteria present. And so the more virulent phages are the ones that are lysing these population of hosts sooner, and the less virulent ones are lysing the population later. This CLET turbidity, the turbidity of the culture, basically is a measure of how many bacteria are present and/or the size of those bacteria. This sooner host lysis is corresponding to a population of phages that displays higher virulence. This STA5 is the defector, cheater phage type. And in fact, not only are we seeing these phages that are more virulent, lysing the bacterial population sooner. But even when you've got these phages growing in the same culture as the wild type, they're lysing the population of bacteria sooner. And this is the same as we saw two slides earlier, where the mutant was able to outcompete the wild type by growing its population faster and therefore dominating what's going on in the environment. Now, over here, we have a phage that's the wild type phage, the cooperator. It's displaying a lower level of virulence. Its population grew more slowly. As a consequence, it allowed the bacterial population to grow for longer. The bacterial population, in a sense, was less sick. And this also has the advantage for the phage in allowing the bacterial population to grow to a higher density, which results in more phage infections and therefore more phages produced. And what we have right here is a third type of phage that happens to display a slightly greater virulence than the wild type. And this phage is lysing its the host population a little bit earlier. It's displaying a greater level of virulence. It also displays a slightly shorter latent period and a slightly smaller burst size than wild type, but not nearly as short or not nearly as small as the STA5 mutant displays. If reductions in host health aids parasite transmission, then we would expect that selection would favor greater parasite virulence. So if making the host sicker means that the parasite can move to new hosts faster, you would expect evolution to favor that greater level of sickness that's induced by the parasite. In both cases, that is, whether you're getting greater or lower levels of transmission with greater amounts of parasite virulence, we can envisage an optimal state of host health or disease that could maximally aid in parasite transmission. And that degree of parasite virulence is that results in the maximal rate of transmission, and that is presumably what is selected for. So that degree of parasite virulence that results in this maximal rate of transmission presumably is what is selected for. This optimal virulence should effectively balance total parasite production against the opportunities for parasite transmission. So more parasite production should result in more parasite virulence, but also a higher likelihood of parasite transmission given transmission opportunity, but also may result in a lower potential or potentially lower transmission opportunity. So more parasite, you have greater virulence, but also you have more parasite to move out of the host when there's an opportunity for transmission, but there may be fewer opportunities for such transmission. This is a phage model, or the results of a phage model, that are demonstrating an optimality of virulence. In this case, optimal virulence is that level of virulence that maximizes phage population growth. And this level of virulence that maximizes phage population growth varies as a function of the prevalence of hosts within the phage's environment that have not yet become phage infected. If host prevalence is high, then there will be selection for a greater level of virulence on a per host basis, such that the virus is getting into and then out of cells very quickly, because therefore its progeny viruses can be released and they can find new hosts to infect quickly. Alternatively, if there is fewer hosts present, then there is less strong selection for the viruses to get into and out of hosts quickly. And the result of that is that you have selection instead that is biased towards maximizing the amount of phage progeny that are produced per host infected. This is the economical strategy. This is the strategy that is most efficient, that provides the greatest yield in phage progeny per unit of host infected. So when the opportunities for movement of of parasite progeny between hosts is not high, you don't tend to get selection for high levels of virulence. Instead, you get selection for lower virulence that has the effect of either over short periods or over long periods, maximizing the amount of progeny, parasite progeny that are produced, which has the effect of increasing the potential for there to be transmission. This is very similar to what we saw with the biofilms and the microcolonies. The idea that if a microcolony could grow to larger sizes, which they can achieve if they show cooperative behavior, then ultimately they can produce more progeny, and that may be selected for if the opportunities for those progeny to find new surfaces to colonize are low. So low levels of opportunity for progeny that might select for the production of more progeny or the production of progeny over longer periods of time will have a tendency to select for a reduced level of virulence in parasites, such as these phages. And in environments in where opportunities instead are high, if you can get to those opportunities fast enough, that can instead select for high levels of virulence that can result in, over the short term, much higher production of progeny and therefore the acquisition of new hosts or new opportunities sooner. So down here we have host cell density against the optimal latent period. As the latent period goes up, basically the virulence goes down, and we're seeing a variation in what latent period is optimal, therefore what level of virulence is optimal displayed by these phages as a function of the host cell density. And as host cell density increases, the optimal latent period decreases, meaning the virulence increases. As host cell density declines, there's less opportunities to find new hosts. You have selection for higher levels, higher latent periods, which correspond to higher burst sizes per infection and correspond to a lower level of virulence displayed by this parasite. So this is a measure of virulence. The higher the virulence equals, the lower the number. And this is a measure, the host cell density is a measure of transmission opportunity. The greater opportunity corresponds with the higher number.